I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
There's a lot happening these days, but I have just the thing to get you up to speed on what matters without taking too much of your time. The 7 from the Washington Post is a podcast that gives you the 7 most important and interesting stories, and we always try to save room for something fun. You get it all in about 7 minutes or less. I'm Hannah Jewell. I'll get you caught up with the 7 every weekday. So follow the 7 right now.
Hi, this is Newt. 2020 is going to be one of the most extraordinary election years of our lifetime. I want to invite you to join my inner circle as we discuss each twist and turn in the presidential race in my members-only Inner Circle Club. You'll receive special flash briefings, online events, and members-only audio reports from me and my team. Here is a special offer for my podcast listeners. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. And if you sign up for a 1 or 2 year membership, you'll get 10% off your membership price and a VIP fast pass to my live events. Join my inner circle today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast. Use the code podcast at checkout. Sign up today at newtsinnercircle.com/podcast and use the code podcast. Hurry, this offer expires February 14th.
On this episode of Newt's World.
You know, I came from a family that suffered from addiction to alcohol. My father really had problems with alcohol. And my mother was, you know, really debilitated by her alcoholism and depression. And of course, my father suffered tremendous post-traumatic stress. There's no one who would better fit a candidate for suffering from PTSD than my late father after he witnessed his brothers being shot, killed. The fact of the matter is my family was very emotionally impacted and psychologically impacted by everything that happened. And my brother and sister and I grew up in that house where all of that was going on.
On this episode of Newt's World, I'm joined by Congressman Patrick Kennedy for a candid discussion on what it's like growing up as a Kennedy, following in his father and uncle's footsteps into public office, only to have addiction tear his life apart, and ultimately causing him to hit rock bottom. Now in his own recovery, he's become a leading national voice in addiction issues and sobriety, mental health issues, and our current national discussion about the legalization of marijuana. I've known him for many years, and it's a privilege to have him join me to tell his personal story. Patrick, tell us about the day you hit rock bottom, the car crash at the U.S. Capitol that made national headlines.
Sure, Mr. Speaker, and it's great to be with you and to share an opportunity to talk about an issue that I think is really at the core an existential crisis for our country, and that's the epidemic of addiction and mental illness and the rising suicide and overdose rates and the enormous number of people who are suffering from addiction and depression and anxiety underneath that terrible tip of the iceberg, which are the completed suicides and overdoses. You know, this is a very personal issue to me, and I think it's probably personal to most Americans. I come at it from a number of different perspectives. First and foremost, I myself am someone who lives in long-term recovery, and that means I haven't had to use alcohol or mind-altering substance since February 22nd, 2011. And what happened to me, like what happens to most people who end up in recovery, is that we hit a bottom. And that bottom for me began when I had that car crash in the United States Capitol. It was a number of years after that that I decided that I could not sustain my service in Congress, given the fact that my addiction was a progressive illness and it was getting worse and worse. And I worried about some incident like the car crash happening again if I didn't leave Congress and devote myself full time to my recovery, which is what I did in 2010. But I say all that because for those who are listening, you know, it's often a very circuitous route that we take to finally reach sobriety. The car accident was, if you will, a real wake-up call, even though I was essentially unconscious when I was driving because I had been taking Ambien in order to try to sleep. This was about 3 months after I got out of rehab for Oxycontin addiction, and I found it very difficult to sleep because I'd often self-medicated with Oxycontin. What happened to me was I woke up the next day and my car wasn't where I had parked it, and I had this panic overcome me. I went to the Capitol, I voted a couple of times, and then I got a call in the cloakroom. And my chief of staff said that I had better come back because he had learned from the Capitol Police that I had crashed my car into a security barrier. Apparently, at 3 in the morning the night before, I had gotten up, gotten to my car, thought I needed to vote, and went to drove to the Capitol and wherein I crashed my car. You know, it was, as you can imagine, a cluster of national media kind of descended upon me as everyone tried to figure out, you know, where I had been the night before, you know, what influence was I under, did I go to a bar, and it was the usual kind of, you know, prurient interest in someone else's tragedy. And, you know, what happened was that I went back to rehab. I thought I was going to lose my political career because, of course, people were calling on me to resign my office. I went to back to rehab, but I spent the whole time there as opposed to just getting in and out, which I had done just a few months earlier because I was worried that anyone would find out that I had been to rehab. This time, essentially, the gig was up. If you will, people knew that I had been suffering, and I had to admit it myself.
Is there a lesson the rest of us can learn from your experience?
I guess at the end of the day, what I think is the most important challenge for us as a nation is what was a challenge for me personally, and that is coming to the realization that I had a problem. They say for those who suffer from mental illness and addiction that we're the last ones to know that we have a problem. And it's the lack of insight that is the single characteristic of anyone suffering from a mental illness and addiction. And I would say that not only do many of us suffer a lack of insight if we're not constantly working on a greater consciousness about our illness, but I think our country is suffering from a lack of insight as to how impactful these illnesses are and how little attention we give to actually addressing a better strategy for addressing these illnesses.
What was the turning point? How have you stayed sober?
If people want help, there is help. Unfortunately, there isn't a system which is in place that works in an optimal way to kind of give them the best chance of reaching sobriety. You know, we could put that system together. Mr. Speaker, it should be put together and incorporate both the medical system as well as other systems. And yet we just haven't gotten about the process of putting the political will to create that system. This is a chronic illness. It's not something that can just be addressed with a quick, you know, rehab, or it is kind of a lifetime commitment to recovery, much like someone with diabetes would struggle with trying to keep their sugar in balance and try to, on a day-to-day basis, manage an illness that requires their constant attention. That's what recovering from addiction requires. So I would tell them that, you know, 12-step recovery is, in my view, the best, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy that I know of. And I have pretty much surveyed every type of treatment and therapy that there is in this country. Personally, I've kind of been on this Lewis and Clark voyage myself through every type of rehab and inpatient and outpatient and psychiatric treatment there is. So I know of what I speak, and that is that there's, at the end of the day, nothing that works better than being in recovery with your peers, because the best way to achieve lasting sobriety is to build a network of support. And professionals can be very helpful, but they cannot be there in the kind of ongoing way than your friends and those that are, you know, walking and trudging the road with you in recovery. So I would encourage them to find recovery through the 12-step programs, which are available to all, and frankly are, you know, working miracles every single day all across this country and all across the world.
If somebody walks up to you and says, you know, I know that I'm addicted, I really would like to go through a recovery program, but when I try, I just seem to fail. What's your advice to that person? How do you sort of hold their hand or try to help them have a sense of that they can get through it?
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't feel like a death sentence, but I know that to people who, you know, are trying to think about getting on the road to recovery and kind of what that means, you know, we take it really simply, and that is, it's just for today. You know, we just decide today not to drink or take drugs. You know, as my sponsor tells me, you know, tomorrow, Patrick, you can, you know, have the biggest, wildest party and do everything you want tomorrow, but just not for today, just today. And then, you know, tomorrow comes around, I make the decision, well, no, today I'm not going to drink or drug, you know, or if it's a really a difficult day, you know, this afternoon I'm not going to work, or, you know, for the next hour. And then I call my sponsor, I call my support group, and I get help, because what I end up doing is plugging into whatever's going on in their life. And, you know, then I find that they've got their own challenges that day, and they're sharing those with me, and all of a sudden I don't feel as much alone. And I really think it's that notion of constantly being connected to other people in a very intimate way. That is what recovery is about. And so it's not something that you really, you know, don't want to do for the rest of your life. In fact, it's an ongoing process of trying to do what, you know, is frankly been very foreign to people who have fallen into addiction, and that is to connect with people, because these illnesses of addiction really isolate you and disconnect you from your friends and family. And the best way to, you know, treat these illnesses is to engage in real intimate connections where you're sharing everything that's going on in your life. You're not holding back. You're not shaming yourself. You're honest about what your challenges are. And as a result, life is a little bit easier to shoulder. And so I would also say that there's an element here of spirituality, a very important element. And what we say in recovery is that our drinking and drugging is but a symptom of our problem. And our problem is a lack of power. We cannot solve all the problems that we want to in our lives. And that's the reason we drink and drug, is to self-medicate, because we can't manage. We need a power. And that power is God for me. As you may know, gone back to my religion of my childhood. I have baptized all my children, and my wife and I have gotten married in the Catholic Church. We initially got a civil marriage, and then decided that we wanted to get married in the church, and went through a process to do that. At the same time, frankly, we recently baptized our fifth child. So life to me in recovery is much more than not drinking or drugging. It's about how to live a life that is, you know, frankly, kind of follows the ancient tenets of, you know, what we should be doing with our lives, as opposed to falling victim to what they call the seven deadly sins: pride, anger, envy, greed, lust, gluttony, and sloth. And all I know is that those seven deadly sins have been bedevilments for me, and I need God's help in order to extinguish them. And I often get God's help through turning to my fellows in recovery. And that, to me, is what being in long-term sobriety means.
When we come back, we'll talk about what it was like growing up in the Kennedy family and being a congressman at the same time your father is the senior senator from Massachusetts. I think one of your amazing accomplishments during your service in Congress was getting the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008 signed into law. Will you tell us that story?
Well, as you know, Mr. Speaker, at the time that I had come back from rehab, I was still the main sponsor of the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, which basically said that insurance companies couldn't treat illnesses of the brain any differently than they reimbursed for other illnesses of the body. And it seems so rational and obvious, but as you mentioned, it's not an easy prospect when we are living in this nation with so much denial about the fact that these are real illnesses, and that all that we've learned from neuroscience, you know, we've actually known intuitively for years, and that is that these are real, they're physical, they're debilitating, and they're deadly. So the irony of all ironies is I won my next election, and it was the following session that we passed the parity bill. And the amazing thing is, you know, due to the untimely death of Paul Wellstone, a tragic passing of Paul Wellstone on the Senate side, he was our main champion on the Senate side, it had to fall on my late father, Senator Edward Kennedy, to sponsor the legislation as the chairman of the committee. Basically, you know, he took over for leading that legislation, which meant that I had to negotiate with my late father in what went into the parity bill. And that is pretty much illustrative of what, you know, we as a nation are grappling with, and that is coming to grips with this. My father was of a prior generation that really didn't want to acknowledge that these were real illnesses, because they were brought up with the idea that they were character flaws and there were moral weaknesses, and that was the generation that he came from. So he was, needless to say, very distraught and upset with me for a good part of my life while I was suffering from these illnesses, and he really just thought I needed a good swift kick in the ass, which in some respects I probably needed. But that was the attitude that he had as to how to treat these illnesses, and that it was really stern and disciplined way. And frankly, our country does it the same way. We arrest people, we incarcerate people, we punish people for their illnesses. So I had to negotiate with my father, and the Senate bill did not include addiction and depression and anxiety and post-traumatic stress. It only included what they called biologically based disorders. You know, so that was kind of the classic fight in this country is what is a real mental illness? So needless to say, he did help me pass the House bill, which was the more expansive version of the parity law. And that happened because he asked his friend Chris Dodd to help me. And Chris wrote the whole TARP bill into our H.R. 1424. And that was the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, which means that, Mr. Speaker, I'm the sponsor not only of the parity law, but technically speaking, I'm the sponsor of the largest federal bailout of our nation's banks in our country's history, just to show people how this bill did not pass because there was some great outcry from the American public that, you know, they wanted their friends and family members to no longer be discriminated against. It happened because it was in the Senate, and it was Chris Dodd was my dad's friend, and my dad was really dying at the time, and my dad had asked Chris to help him with this, get my bill off the desk. And Chris, you know, of course, just happened at the same time to be facing this economic crisis that hit this country with the banking collapse. And what he decided to do is take that whole bailout of our banks and put that whole legislation into H.R. 1424 in order to get our bill to pass. And, of course, you can't make it up. That's how it passed. And again, the paradox is that bill was meant to stop our country from going into another great financial depression, like we saw in the 30s. And the underlying bill mandated treatment of depression for Americans.
Patrick, we go back many years. People often are surprised because Washington is seen as such a partisan place. I have to ask you, you know, on our side of the aisle, we always saw your dad as a really tough negotiator who was very determined, often pleasant, but very firm in what he wanted. What was your experience trying to negotiate with him? I would think there are a lot of cross pressures when you both represent the House, but you're also his son.
Yes. So the other perspective that I didn't talk about when I introduced the subject of my suffering from addiction was that, you know, I came from a family that suffered from addiction to alcohol. My father really had problems with alcohol. And my mother was, you know, really debilitated by her alcoholism and depression. And, my father suffered tremendous post-traumatic stress. If you ever wanted to look up post-traumatic stress in the dictionary, there's no one who would better fit a candidate for suffering from PTSD than my late father after he, you know, witnessed his brothers being shot, killed, and numerous other tragedies. And so, you know, the fact of the matter is my family was very emotionally impacted and psychologically impacted by everything that happened to my family. And my brother and sister and I grew up in that house and where all of that was going on. And I think that really had an impact on our own mental health. I think it's a genetic illness. Personally, I think the depression that my mother suffered from, her mother suffered from, her mother died at 61 and wasn't found for a week in her single room apartment in Cocoa Beach, Florida. And that is frankly emblematic of anybody who suffers from an alcoholic death. They're often alone because these illnesses isolate people. You know, my mother suffered from that. My aunt, Candy, my mother's sister, suffered from it. All but one of her children suffered from it, as did my brother and sister and I.
Just as an individual has to come to grips with whether it's an addiction or it's a mental illness, we as a country now have such depth of problems with both addiction and with untreated or inappropriately treated mental illness that we almost need a national coming to grips parallel to what an individual has to do. I mean, I think that's a very interesting insight on your part to frame it that way. And I know you've been a tremendous advocate for making sure that we deal with mental health parity as a part of this. And you want to just for a minute share with all of us the struggle you had to get people to understand that mental health is integral to your health and to have a system which is
only dealing with the physical side is to have a system which is utterly inadequate for the reality of how humans function.
Frankly, I travel the country. I've spoken about this and the need for insurance companies to reimburse for these illnesses. I find that, you know, everybody has a story. And what's shocking to me is that no one wants to really make the move or talk about it. And that's how I found in my own family, no one wanted to talk about these things. They were supposed to be secrets. Of course, in my family, all of our secrets were published in numerous books. But in spite of that, I still myself thought that I had to keep, you know, the family secrets. And I think it's that silence, Mr. Speaker, that is really destructive to our country. I think we need to acknowledge and be proactive in intervening and preventing these illnesses from pathologizing by doing more in terms of early intervention. And we're losing so many people in this country because we're not doing what we know works. And that's what's so frustrating to me.
Next, we'll have a candid discussion about the legalization of marijuana.
An unfairly discharged Marine with a dark secret. A brilliant intelligence officer recovering from tragedy. This unlikely pair are brought together to stop a deadly Russian plot against the heart of the American system. Number one, New York Times best-selling authors Newt Gingrich and Pete Early return with a new series filled with action and intrigue that captures the tensions and divides of America and the world today. Collusion, a novel by Newt Gingrich. Available on Amazon.com and Audible now.
In the United States, there are now 10 states that have legalized the use of marijuana for recreational purposes. Alaska, California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Nevada, Oregon, Vermont, and Washington. And another 22 states have legalized marijuana for medical treatment. Patrick, against this backdrop of legalization that is sweeping our nation, what do we know about the emerging business of big marijuana and the short-term and long-term health effects of marijuana use?
We love our addictions in America. We love our addictions. I live not too far from Atlantic City. I mean, it's everywhere. And we as a nation are suffering enormous and epidemic rates of addiction just overall. It's just a question of this will not be a solution to trying to stop future addiction if we were to end this idea that it's okay to commercialize this new addictive drug. But it's just doing what we can to stop the pipeline of people that are going to fall into addiction because they're lulled into this false sense that, you know, marijuana is really not that addictive and that it's not going to be a gateway and lead to other addictive substances and to a life that will really be disabled because of the fact that they're dependent on using marijuana to solve their depression or their anxiety or whatever it might be because everyone's telling them that it's medical and it's okay and there's no problem with it. That is kind of the reminiscent of the early days when tobacco was really commercialized and there were doctors, you know, smoking a certain type of cigarette. And that was a very well kind of thought through strategy, you know, 50 years ago when big tobacco was getting started. And frankly, big marijuana has followed the same well orchestrated strategy of introducing the idea of legalization after first de-risking it in the public's mind by marketing marijuana as a medical product. And what that's done is really made people feel like there's really no problem in using marijuana because it's being accepted as some type of medicine. So I just see this major problem that conflicts with our public health needs, and that is that there is a profit motive in getting more people to use. I mean, that's the nature of capitalism. You know, you want more people to use your product, and that's where you derive your profits. But in this case, if more people use marijuana,
that's not going to be good for the public health of our country. It's not going to be good for the future of our country when you consider the stark increase in teenage use of marijuana in those states where it has been legalized. And we know a little bit about the impact of marijuana on the developing brain. We don't know enough, but I'd hate to think that our intuition and our gut is wrong when it says that we will pay a heavy price by waiting for another 20 years to find out whether we knew intuitively what was going to happen, and that is that this was not going to be good for young people and that it was going to lead to a lot of disability, and you know that we had a chance to stop it early on, but we didn't do it, even though our common sense told us that it was something that we should do.
I'd like to talk about the states where marijuana has been legalized. Can you talk about their ineffectiveness to properly regulate the industry?
Marijuana obviously is building and amassing more and more power as the market for selling marijuana grows and grows because of legalized marijuana in the various states. And just like other powerful industries, when you amass great wealth in a given industry, that wealth can be put to use, you know, for stifling kind of regulations that would otherwise impede the making of additional money. You know, we are really seeing the impact of a huge lobby effort by big marijuana in these states to allow for the commercialization of products that are, like I said, elixirs, which are drinks where THC is infused, edibles, which are all kinds of foods which THC is infused into, as well as the kind of vaping products. I mean, for anybody over 40, they just don't know what the new marijuana that we're talking about really is all about. And I just am concerned that we're going to wake up, you know, and we're going to wonder how in the world do we let this happen, especially after having learned our lessons from the over-marketing of OxyContin by Purdue Pharma. And everybody is so outraged by that, the more and more they learn about how Purdue Pharma really influenced CMS to change their regulatory oversight to really make pain and the indicator of pain one of the real indicators for the prescribing of OxyContin. And so essentially the money was so big that it was influencing the American Medical Association, American Hospital Association, CMS. It was having a very destructive influence. And I use that as a kind of metaphor for what is going to happen with marijuana. It's going to have a lot of money, and that money is going to have a very pernicious and destructive impact in the public policy that's developed to kind of in concert with the legalization insofar as regulation is concerned, and that public health element is just not going to be taken into account.
What's your reaction to the whole wave of legalizing and normalizing marijuana? To what extent are we, in effect, doing something logical, and to what extent are we, in fact, opening the door to what a generation from now people will look back on as a major mistake?
I, you know of how much you have done in the area of criminal justice reform, and I want to once again, you know, say to you that there is a all the indicators show that this has not been the panacea for arrests amongst the minority community, the drug arrests. We are seeing in Colorado between 2012 and 2014 the percentage of Hispanic and African American arrests for teens under 18 increased by 29% and 58% respectively, while white youth decreased in arrests by 8%. That's pretty stark comparison, and that shows that even with legalization, we're not addressing the societal problem of the disproportionate number of arrests amongst minority populations. So anyone who thinks that this pot industry is going to be good for social justice, they're ignoring the fact that most pot shops are in minority neighborhoods as opposed to white neighborhoods who want nothing to do with it. And that's really because we've seen the same with alcohol. There are more liquor stores in minority neighborhoods than white neighborhoods. And that really is the reason why the NAACP of Detroit, the largest branch of the NAACP in the country, has come out against the legalization of marijuana in Michigan. That's why places like Compton, California, have rejected pot shops in their neighborhood, because minority community knows that this is not good for the public health and for their community. And, you know, anybody who's out there thinking they're on some social justice crusade by supporting legalization is just ignorant of what the real facts are.
Next, when you've been through what Patrick Kennedy's been through, how do you fill the hole in the soul?
The Westwood One Podcast Network, The Daily Wire's Ben Shapiro Show.
What's amazing is that Joe Biden then gets called out by his own side and he runs screaming from his own bipartisanship. When people on the left are called out by their own side, they will not step forward to defend people with whom they are purportedly friends very often. It's pretty rare.
The Ben Shapiro Show. Download and subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and the Westwood One Podcast app. Free, free from the Westwood One Podcast Network.
Well, and I can testify that you have a beautiful family and just a wonderful children. And in that sense, there has to be a great deal of joy in your life, which I think is an important thing for people to realize. It's not like you're grimly getting up every morning and saying, well, I'm not going to do drugs today. You're also getting up every day surrounded by your kids and surrounded by with your wife and doing positive things. I mean, I've been on the road with you when you've had a tremendous impact on audiences, so that you have a life that in many ways is remarkably fulfilling at this stage.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It fills the hole in the soul. You know, it really does. I've been blessed to find a purpose in my life, and I thought my purpose was higher office. And I thought that would somehow fill that hole in my soul. And I was driven out of office really because of my inability to try to solve my addiction problem by myself. And the God had bigger plans for me, because after I left Congress, I was able to get married and have five children. And fortunately, I'm trying to every day break the cycle in my family of not exposing them to alcohol and drugs. And I'm fortunate to say that none of them have ever seen me intoxicated. And I'm blessed to be able to say that.
I think it means a lot to America to have you remain a public figure, to have you remain in the middle of this kind of advocacy. And I can tell our audience, based on my being with you around the country, that you do have a real impact, and that people leave having had their minds changed and having a whole new range of thoughts. So I just want to thank you as a fellow citizen for your continued activism and your continued involvement.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Speaker, and I've really enjoyed being able to work with you and to learn from you and to see the impact that you continue to have across the country, especially on how to improve our health care system and the delivery of health care in this country in a more accessible and affordable way.
His personal story of his struggles with addiction and recovery are representative of what many Americans are facing today. As we consider the legalization of marijuana across the country, we ought to remember his story and really consider what don't we know about the effects of long-term marijuana use. Thanks for listening. Thank you to my guest, Congressman Patrick Kennedy. You can learn more about his story and his organization at don'tdenyme.org. at newtsworld.com. Newt's World is produced by Westwood One. The executive producer is Debbie Myers. Our producer is Garnsey Sloan. Our editor is Robert Borowski. Our researcher is Hunter Estes. The artwork for the show was created by Steve Penley. The music was composed by Joey Salvia. Special thanks to the team at Gingrich 360 and Westwood One's Tim Sabian and Robert Mathers. Please subscribe to Newt's World on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get entertaining podcasts. On the next episode of Newt's World, our Immortals series continues with Julius Caesar, a legendary leader who still impacts our lives today. I'm Newt Gingrich. This is Newt's World. The Westwood One Podcast Network. Everyone's listening.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
What's up, y'all? Janice Torres here.
And I'm Austin Hankwitz.
We're the hosts of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories, a podcast presented by iHeartRadio's Ruby Studios and Intuit QuickBooks. Join us as we speak with small business owners about the tools they use to turn their ideas into success.
From finding that initial spark of entrepreneurship to organizing payments and invoices, we've got you covered. So follow and listen to Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories on the iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.